Always keep in view, Brigham Young exhorts us, that the animal, vegetable, and mineral kingdoms, the earth and its fullness, will all, except the children of men, abide their creation, the law by which they were made, and will receive their exaltation. We are all going to move together into the eternities, and even now look forward to heaven, the paradise of God, the happiness of man, and of beasts, and of creeping things, and of the fowls of the air, that which is spiritual being in the likeness of that which is temporal, the spirit of man in the likeness of his person, as also the spirit of the beast, and every other creature which God has created. What an admonition to proceed with reverence and care! It is only because the Latter-day Saints are ignorant of these things, according to President Young, that God has not already cursed them for their brutal and callous treatment of God's other creatures. Normative Judaism and Christianity, following the lead of Aristotle and the doctors of Alexandria, have always rejected and resented the idea that animals might in any degree be classed with men, who alone, according to the perennial doctrine of the schools, enjoy the powers of speech and reason, the mark of divinity that sets them uniquely and absolutely apart. Man is bound to treat dumb animals kindly and to abstain from unnecessary cruelty, an eminent churchman has recently written, not because these animals possess any real rights, for only intelligent beings can have real rights, but because they are creatures of God. The Latter-day Saints, on the other hand, do not take the view that animals have no reason and cannot think. We have divine knowledge that each possesses a spirit in the likeness of its body, and that each was created spiritually before it was given a body on the earth. Naturally, then, there is some measure of intelligence in members of the animal kingdom. Animals do possess real rights, for all things have an equal right to live, as President Joseph F. Smith would say. We are told that early Christian groups avoided the eating of meat, not as the flesh of irrational beasts, but as belonging to creatures having rational souls. Schopenhauer observed that the two most serious defects of Christian teaching are, 1. The denial of spirits to all creatures but man, and 2. Of life to all worlds but this one. These closely related doctrines have formed the common ground on which fundamentalism and scientism have joined hands, the former horrified at the thought of being related to lower creatures than man, the latter scorning any suggestion that we might be related to higher ones. God and Satan both presented plans of dominion to Adam and then to his son Cain. The father chose one plan, the son the other. It must be admitted that the second proposition was a very tempting offer and very skillfully presented. Satan tempted me, is the stock excuse for giving in. But we must go back to Adam to see how clever the thing really is. The story is told not only of Adam, but of the other great patriarchs as well. Noah was confronted by the same party with the same proposition while he was working in his garden after the flood. Abraham, too, had an Eden and an altar. And while he was once calling upon God in prayer, Satan suddenly showed up with an insolent, "Here I am," and proceeded with his sales pitch. Moses, like Christ, was tempted on a mountain, by the same person and with the same proposal, "If thou wilt worship me, all shall be thine." Adam is thus only the first. The elements of the story that follow are found in various combinations among the many texts of the growing Adam literature that is coming to light in our generation. The texts often take dramatic form, indicative of ritual origin. As Adam was praying one day, runs the story, a distinguished gentleman appeared on the scene and engaged him in conversation. There was nothing of the hippie or tramp about the stranger. He was well-dressed and came to Adam with cunning and smooth talk, as a true friend genuinely concerned for his welfare. He began with some harmless generalities, the weather and the scenery. It was, he observed, a most glorious and beautiful world. This was, however, by way of leading up to his next point, which was that he happened to be the owner and proprietor of it all. Yes, sir, as far as the eye could see, it was all his, and he tolerated no nonsense in it. Nobody dared make trouble where he was in charge. This was all hokum, of course. Satan never owned the earth. He never made a particle of it, said Brigham Young. His labor is not to create, but to destroy. But to demonstrate his authority, when three strangers, usually described as angels, appeared on the scene at this moment, he at once challenged them as trespassers, asking them if they had any money. He explained to Adam that everything in his world could be had for money, and then got down to business. For the fellow was all business, a person of integrity, ready to keep his part of an agreement. The agreement always turns out to be a trap for the other party. Pious and God-fearing, dedicated to hard work, he works, in fact, like a demon. He was there to offer Adam the chance of a lifetime, to buy in on a scheme that would give him anything he wanted in this world. It was an ingenious and simple self-financing operation, in which one would buy power with wealth, and then more wealth with the power, until one might end up owning and controlling everything. The initial capital? It was right under their feet. You begin by taking the treasures of the earth and converting them to cash, gold, and silver. By exchanging them for the services of important people in key positions, you end up running everything your way. What if your rule is one of blood and terror? Better to reign in hell, as Milton Satan puts it, than serve in heaven. Satan's tempting proposition has been the theme of much popular legend and great literature. A transitional figure between the ritual and the literary is Pluto of Hades, the god of wealth. All the riches of gems and precious metals hidden beneath the earth are his, but he owns no property above ground. So he brutally kidnaps the fair Proserpina, who represents all the beauty and harmony of nature, to establish his claim over the earth. But the marriage is barren. Pluto can intimidate and coerce, but like his Egyptian counterpart Seth, he can neither beget nor create. What he buys with the treasures of the earth is nothing but a rule of blood and horror. But Greek comedy and Roman satire depict with agonizing frankness the irresistible success of Pluto's program in a decadent world. In Aristophanes' last play, the Pluto, Hermes, the messenger of Zeus, comes to earth as a prophet to denounce mankind for having turned from the worship of heaven to the worship of wealth, or Pluto. "You have all committed a great sin," he says, "and must be destroyed." But seeing how well the people are living, he soon decides to change sides and asks for a job with the establishment. Next, the high priest of Zeus, finding himself unemployed, is forced to apply to Pluto for a job. What is his surprise when he finds none other than Zeus himself now working in the front office of Pluto, Inc.? The cynical conclusion is that no one can resist Satan's bargain, and in the history of the world, very few people have. The first to accept was Cain, who loved Satan more than God, though at Satan's advice, he continued to make offerings to the Lord. The great secret of success that he learned from his new teacher was that he could get anything in this world by the calculated use of force, with no need to be ashamed, since it could all be done in the sacred name of freedom. Instead of being appalled at the blood on his hands, Cain gloried in that which he had done, saying, "I am free. Surely the flocks, wealth, of my brother falleth into my hands." Cain slew Abel not, as we like to think, in a fit of passion, but with cold calculation, for the sake of getting gain. He was all business. As for the victim, he was quite able to take care of himself, and if he failed, that, by the rules of the new game, was his hard luck. Am I my brother's keeper? Significantly enough, when this forthright, no-nonsense economy, unencumbered by enervating sentimentality, worked against Cain, he straightway became a bleeding heart in his own behalf and appealed for the mercy he would not give. "My punishment is greater than I can bear." In making an example of Cain, God absolutely forbade the use of Cain's own methods against him. "Whoever slayeth thee, vengeance shall be taken on him sevenfold." One of the best-known teachings of the Jews is that when man, Israel in particular, falls away from God, all nature becomes his enemy. Modern revelation confirms this. When all the people became wicked in Enoch's day, the earth trembled, and the mountains fled, and the rivers of water were turned out of their course, and the roar of the lions was heard out of the wilderness. Just so, In the last days, all the growing things will be blighted by the great lawlessness, and plagues will come over all creatures of the earth. Where people refuse the gospel, according to Brigham Young, that land eventually will become desolate, forlorn, and forsaken, as nature refuses her bounties. The explanation of this all-out hostility is simple. The animal, vegetable, and mineral kingdoms abide the law of their Creator. The whole earth and all things pertaining to it, except man, abide the law of their creation, while man, who is the offspring of the gods, will not become subject to the most reasonable and self-exalting principles. With all things going in one direction, men, stubbornly going in the opposite direction, naturally find themselves in the position of one going the wrong way on the freeway during rush hour. The struggle to live becomes a fight against nature. Having made himself allergic to almost everything by the fall, man is given the choice of changing his nature so that the animal and vegetable creation will cease to afflict and torment him, or else of waging a truceless war of extermination against all that annoys him until he renders the earth completely uninhabitable. This second course is Cain's dominion. Satan, spitefully determined to destroy everything that God has commanded to live and multiply, began his earthly career by making war on the birds and fishes and systematically destroying the animals and trees. This, we are told, was because he was envious of the beautiful rapport that existed between Adam and the animals. Next, under the administration of his pupil Cain, all the forests of the earth rapidly disappeared, while that hero wandered through the earth with his bow for 130 years, looking for anything to kill, a human angel of death. While Noah refused Satan's plan to divide up the world and rule with an iron hand, his sons accepted it, each driving out from his property all the animals as trespassers, so that the beasts that had loved Noah began to fear and hate man. In particular, Ham organized secret combinations to work iniquity and to shed much blood, and after this they sinned against the beasts and birds and all that moves and walks on the earth. Next, Ham's son Nimrod, the mighty hunter who boasted that no animal could escape his bow, turned that bow against men as well as animals, and so subdued all things to his will, ruling all the earth with his inspired violence. He was the mortal enemy and rival of Abraham. And whereas Abraham gave Adam's blessing to the beasts, Nimrod ordered thousands of cattle brought and sacrificed them. This he was able to do through possession of the garment of the priesthood that had once belonged to Adam and that Ham had stolen from Noah. Seeing him in this garment, all creatures willingly came and submitted to him, mistaking the dominion of Cain for the dominion of Adam. From Nimrod, Esau, another hunter, inherited the garment, but lost it to Jacob, from whom it passed down to Moses, who, when it wore out, replaced it with a garment of cotton or hair, rather than skins to avoid the shedding of animal blood. These interesting old stories might be dismissed as literary oddity, were it not that annals and chronicles of real history, a continual scene of wickedness and abominations, are completely dominated by the Nimrod type. The greatest acts of the mighty men proclaim the nature of their dominion. Before them the earth was a paradise, said Joseph Smith, and behind them a desolate wilderness. There is another plan. The designs of God, on the other hand, are that the earth shall yield its increase, resume its paradisian glory, and become as the garden of the Lord. Meanwhile, when we see all the world trying to lord it over God's heritage, we can be sure that it is in the spirit that the evil principle and power is trying to overcome and rule over the divine principle planted there. This constantly leads the children of men astray. To render its appeal irresistible, the program is pushed by a clever rhetoric and high ethical tone. Babylon has never wanted for dedicated and highly paid apologists to justify the ways of those who seek for power and authority and riches. Man's dominion is a call to service, not a license to exterminate. It is precisely because men now prey upon each other and shed the blood and waste the flesh of other creatures without need that the world lieth in sin. Such, at least, is the teaching of the ancient Jews and of modern revelation.